Welcome to Used Car News Podcast. Used Car News is your top source for fast and reliable news that car dealers can rely on for this evolving industry. Here are this month's top stories. The National Automotive Dealers Association convention returns to Texas. Used vehicle prices peaked in 2022. And Automotive Reinsurance Concepts has launched an online subscription education program. But first, we sit down with Eric Johnson of Hudson Cook. Eric is a partner in the firm's Oklahoma City office and editor-in-chief of CounselorLibrary.com's Spot Delivery publication.
Hello, this is Jeff Vellant, managing editor of Used Car News, and this is the Used Car News podcast. Today we have a great guest. This is Eric Johnson from Hudson Cook, and if you're in the auto industry and you're familiar with law and regulation, you've heard of Hudson Cook. So I just wanted to ask Eric to come on and introduce himself. And Eric, tell us about how you got into lawyering and how you got into the auto industry, if you could.
Yeah, you bet. And thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it. And thank you very much for having me here today. I'm a partner with Hudson Cook in our Oklahoma City office, and I'm also editor-in-chief of Counselor Library's Spot Delivery publication. And I practice primarily in auto finance, personal property financing, and leasing space. Although I do, being from Oklahoma in private practice before, you know, have to cover all different areas of credit. But that's primarily my focus and background. I guess how I got into the practice of law. Well, I was a senior at Oklahoma State University, go Cowboys, and was an accounting major, and I was telling my daughter this the other night, I had to take three upper level accounting courses my senior year. And I, after that was over, I just said, I don't want to ever see accounting again. I mean, I like the challenge, but I did not want to do accounting. And it's interesting. My dad was in law school at the time. He was, I think, a first or second year at the time at Oklahoma City University. And so I went to him and said, all right, I've got this choice. I can either try to get my MBA or I can go to law school. You know, you're in law school now. What do you recommend I do? And so he kind of talked me into going to law school. Sounded like a real challenge, like an avenue to do some really challenging work, but also help people at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's how I started into law school.
That's interesting. Now, that's interesting. Your father was in law school at the same time. What was his path? Not to get off the track too much, but.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if you know this. My family has a car dealership in Kingfisher, a little town outside of Oklahoma City, about 40 miles away. Been in business since 1927, I believe. And whoa. So that was always in the family business. Whenever we moved back to Kingfisher, he worked at the dealership. Managed the parts department there, and he went back to college to finish it and get his college degree, and then just decided, well, while I'm at it, why don't I just go on and get a law degree? So he was working at the dealership part time and then going to law school. That's when they had night classes. I think they still do, but so he was going, you know, doing all day and then going to night law school at night. So
what does he do now?
He's retired now, but he was, after he graduated law school, he sold out of his interest in the family business. And then he was in private practice for a while. Then he practiced at the state for a number of years and then eventually retired and is in Colorado now. So
nice to have somebody to, you know, bounce stuff off of and feedback. And
yep.
Excellent. Excellent. So what brought you in? What got you? Well, I guess that might be a dumb question now. Because of your dealership background, is that what got you into auto industry law?
I'd say so. I mean, although it took me a longer path to get there. Mm-hmm. After law school, I actually practiced aviation law for about 5 years.
Really?
A smaller boutique firm here in Oklahoma City. All of the aircraft around the United States have to be registered, and they're bought and sold, they're financed. All of that is done at the Mike Monroney Center, Aeronautical Center here in Oklahoma City. And so there's a lot of firms that are kind of boutique firms that are built up around aircraft finance. I had no idea what I was getting into at the time, but sounded cool, sounded interesting. And so I did that for a number of years before I left to go to Austin and work in-house at Dell Financial, where we financed computer purchases
Right.
and systems, big system purchases, and got a just kind of a little taste of consumer law at the time. Most of my clients were, commercial. It was the business side, more on the commercial side than say consumer. But I got a taste of it, and it was a challenge for sure and interesting. And then moved back to after 9/11, my wife and I decided to move back to Oklahoma. And I started practicing with another firm here in Oklahoma City, where that's all I did was consumer financial services, representing, any wide range of company, mortgage companies, dealerships, auto finance companies. And that's when I really started getting a taste for practicing in the auto finance space, just based on
Excellent.
my background and working at the dealership since I was a kid, all the way through college, and just, knowing that type of world and the people that are in it. So.
Very good. I mean, I've been familiar with you, but I didn't know that background, so that's really interesting. Just one last thing before we get into the auto stuff. What's a typical term of a aviation finance deal? I mean,
Well,
what
it depends. I mean, there were some that, for, I don't know, 20, 30 years that they're financed. I mean, when you look at some of the fleet that, at least at the time that I was dealing with it, some
Yeah.
of our fleet were really old. I mean, we're talking late 60s, early 70s that have been around for a long, these aircraft have been in service for a long time. There's that. Then there are some, some of the carriers that we did business for that, brand new, right off the line, $30 million, and that was cheap probably at the time, $30 million, jets that are coming right out. So, real interesting, and I'd say very creative financing.
Yeah, I
But, you
bet.
know, a lot, and a lot of it's driven, of course, as you might suspect, around tax issues, where
Yes.
if it's on the U.S. registry one day, then, well, we've got to take it off, get it off the registry and put it on, I don't know, the Netherlands or whatever by Monday,
Oh,
because it's all
really?
driven by
Okay.
tax. So.
Gotcha. Very good. Excellent. Excellent. So, okay, we told you a little bit about the background. At Hudson Cook, now you mentioned part of your thing is in the auto finance space. What do you like best about your job at Hudson Cook and working in the automotive space?
Yeah, that's a good question. What I like best, I think, working at the firm is just my partners and colleagues here. It's interesting because before I came to Hudson Cook in 2013, I was with I wouldn't say a competing firm. It was a firm that, I'd see the Hudson Cook attorneys at different conferences, ABA meetings, and other co industry conferences. Some of the nicest, most knowledgeable, smartest people that I'd probably ever met. And they were practicing the type of law that I was, trying to practice, really trying to, build up my practice in. So I think that's what I like the best is just folks here in the firm are just so nice, so smart, knowledgeable. And if I ever need assistance or help with something, I can just pick up the phone or email or text, and they're there to help guide me through whatever issue or question we've got at the time.
Yeah, that's great. As a reporter, I'll say the same thing about Hudson Cook and you, that, the best thing about this job is, you learn so much and you can ask. And being a reporter, people expect you to ask questions. So it's great to talk to folks like you guys, and you do learn a lot. And you're right. People, not just you, but the people I've spoken with at Hudson Cook over, years and years have been same way. Very helpful. Very let you know what they can talk about, what they can't talk about, but what they can, they're really generous. So that is excellent. What
Yeah.
about the challenges now of working in this space?
Boy, there's a lot of challenges, I think. I mean, and I think it's just kind of snowballed the last, well, certainly with the CFPB coming online. I mean, it was consumer finance was a big field before. I always say it's deep and it's wide, but certainly when the Bureau came online in 2010, 2011 with Dodd-Frank, it certainly expedited things. And now the last couple of years with the FTC commission, where you've got a Democrat led committee or commission now, they've certainly just been cranking out, you know, proposed rules, and there's been a lot more enforcement activity against car dealerships and other players in the industry. So I think just the challenge of keeping up with all the stuff before, you know, pre-Dodd-Frank, mm-hmm. and you've got all these new rules and opinions and circulars. I mean, just the activity, it's just a lot to juggle. I tell folks it's like spinning plates and juggling at the same time. It's hard to keep the plates spinning and the balls in the air because there's just so much out there.
You know, I didn't mention this, but this is interesting. You saying that, you mentioned that your editor-in-chief of Spot Delivery, and I would make a plug for the newsletter. It's fantastic for a non-lawyer to get. I mean, it's a deep publication for, you know, it's a brief newsletter, but it's very deep information on the law in this industry. But I would ask you guys, your listeners, to check it out. But what it's interesting, you brought up FTC the FTC and CFPB. What about the idea of now this, I don't know, they're not necessarily working in tandem, but you see some crossover with what state attorneys general are doing and the national thing. Is there trends? I mean, how's the balance of that work? I mean, are you dealing more with the federal stuff or the state stuff or both?
I'd say both, really. I mean, you're right. I always call them like a Marvel team up where we've got, you know, and you've seen this recently with the CPB teaming up with the New York AG.
Yes.
File actions. And we've seen that over the course of the CFPB's tenure, where they will team up with certain states to go after or attack, you know, a dealership, or they'll attack an auto finance company or other creditor. And so I think that is certainly, I mean, the Bureau has a ton of resources and big budget behind them. And so it makes certain amount of sense for a state regulator or AG to want to team up with the Bureau. Got a ton of resources and they've got the bodies, they've got the money behind them, and it makes sense, I think. So I think it's really activity on both fronts. You know?
Yeah, and they have kind of the same angle too. It's funny, I always think of state AGs as like future governor cabinet gubernatorial candidates, it seems.
Right.
But of course that I guess that is both interesting and challenging for you guys. Now outside of Hudson Cook, I see that you, if this is still true, you serve as the chair of the legal committee for the National Automotive Finance Association. Is that true?
Yeah, that's correct.
And you're co-founder and co-instructor of their consumer credit compliance certification program, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me a little bit about your goal, your role on the Automotive Finance Association. And then secondly, a little bit about the certification program, which I think a lot of people in the business would be interested.
Yeah, you bet. So you're right. I've been the chair of our legal committee for a number of years now, and am a presenter, speaker. You know, we developed their certification program, and I've been, before then I was involved with the NAF. I'd say a long time, ever since I probably moved back to Oklahoma and started practicing in this field. I mean, the NAF is just, I mean, I think it's kind of like the exclusive forum, one of the only forums, I'd say, for the non-prime auto finance industry.
Yes.
And I mean, great conferences, ton of interesting speakers. And so it's a great way to get a lot of knowledge, I think, by just attending one conferences and, you know, as well as meeting people in the industry too, both other attorneys as well as, you know, players in the industry.
So as the chair of the legal committee, what are some of the things you focus on? Or if you want to say, what are some of the big issues you're dealing with in that specific role?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, the majority of what we do is try to keep the NAF membership apprised of what's going on from a, you know, litigation standpoint or regulatory standpoint. We will typically put on a session at the annual conference where I'll try to get as many members as we can from the committee to come in, and we'll kind of divvy up what's the hot new trends right now, or what issues are folks dealing with, and then we'll present on those, and then be available, of course, for questions on those types of issues. And I try to bring in folks that, I mean, have a deep, kind of a deep knowledge or understanding of what those issues are, but are able to explain it in a way that, you know, you don't need a law degree or don't need an advanced degree to really necessarily understand it. And then, you know, outside of that, we will try to do different, you know, whether it's articles for their publication, non-prime times, or other alerts like that, to just keep the industry abreast of what they need to be watching out for.
And the NF, that coincides with NADA, is that right?
No, that's AFSA.
Okay, all right.
Usually
all right.
AFSA.
When is your conference usually then?
Usually it's early June.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Excellent. So people keep your eye out for it. And then, of course, we always love to talk about education, the automotive space. So your instructor, the Consumer Credit Compliance Certification Program, that seems like, one, what is that? And two, who would you recommend be part of that?
So it's a program that I'd say helps consumer finance companies and other stakeholders in the industry really try to understand and tackle the complexities of the federal and state laws and regulations that apply to consumer financing or automotive financing. And my partner, Patty Covington, and I developed the program with the outlines and the test questions. And then there for many years, we would have two of the modules. It's a 4-module program, but two of the modules we would present in person for like typically a day and a half or so. The first module is really just kind of an introduction to consumer credit. We walk through the basics of how it works. We go through a sampling of like the state laws. We even go through a sample of transactional documents. And then we talk about the state regulators, who they are, what they're interested in, how to talk to them, how to deal with them.
Oh, that's helpful. Yeah.
Then we go kind of an overview of the federal regulators, not just the CPB, but there's another, you know, others that are out there. And then module 2, 3, and 4 are kind of really, I'd say, focused outside of just the basics. Like module 2 is where you go through the applicable federal laws and regs, and there are various outlines and test questions that you have to pass before you go to the next outline. Mm-hmm. And then module 3 is the state, similar kind of a broad overview of the state. And then module 4 is just CFPB, where we spend basically a day and a half talking about CFPB, who they are, how they get their funding, what they're interested in, compliance management systems, how to handle an examination, how to handle, like, you may receive a civil investigative demand, all of that. So it's a really good, I'd say that one's a really deep dive on the Bureau and what they're focused on.
Would this be applicable for, say, independent dealer or a subprime or buy here payer? Is there a certain type of person in the industry who would be good for this program?
Yeah, I think it was intended originally for automotive finance companies.
Right.
I mean, that's probably the lion's share of it. But if you look at, I'd say, you know, like a buy here, pay here that has a related finance company, well,
yes,
they're going to play by the same rules as a independent auto finance company. An independent dealer that maybe originates the contracts and keeps and services and collects their contracts, they too are going to be playing by the same rules, or should be playing by the same rules as the bigger auto finance companies would be. So, and we've had a number of independent dealers that have gone through the program and buy here, pay here dealers. And so I think it's really helpful to them as well, not just say a big auto finance company.
For sure. And I would guess that would help them even just be able to speak the language if they have to interact with regulators or something, to be able to talk the same language. And then they kind of show they know a little bit. That kind of helps them out, I would assume, in any type of investigation.
Yeah. I mean, I think in large part, it's just, you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, this at least, you know, helps the light bulb go off to say, wait a minute, I see an issue here. I don't know how to resolve that issue. I don't know how to answer the issue, but I know I can recognize that there could be a problem.
Yes. Very
and
good.
Then, you know, that helps.
For you and Patty, what prompted the start of this certification? Did they ask you guys to do something, or how did that work out?
Yeah. And I think it was the brainchild of, I'd say the NAF board and then their former director, Jack Tracy.
Oh, yeah.
Got together and decided, you know, we need, there's not an educational program like this that's just geared for, say, auto finance. I mean, there are others out there, but right. A lot of it's banking, you know, kind of touches on some of these laws, but nothing that's specific to the automotive industry. And I think at the time, Jack had worked with Patty primarily. And then she brought me in and we started putting flesh to the bone and say, well, what if we did this? What if we did that? And so we just kind of spec'd out what we thought the program should look like. And then it just took off from there.
How long has it been around?
Oh, boy. I would say it's tough because you always lose track of years.
No, that's for sure.
During the COVID year. I mean, it's say probably at least 7 or 8 years. We've had, I think, over 700, if not more, graduates go through and actually become certified through the program.
Fantastic. Excellent. Yeah, definitely something to check out. Okay, so in terms of the current landscape in auto finance, what are the challenges that your clients are facing, generally speaking, or the things that you can talk about in this setting?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'd say, you know, generally speaking, I think it's just the deluge of all of the federal laws and all the state laws that folks have to deal with on a daily basis. I mean, there's just so much out there to keep in mind. And, you know, when you take those and you throw in all these new laws and new regs that are being proposed by the regulators, or new enforcement actions that are kind of regulation by enforcement, where you didn't know it was prohibited or restricted until they came out with this enforcement action that tells you it is.
Right.
I think that's, you know, then I think it's just almost a Herculean task for a dealer, and I'd say probably an auto finance company, to follow, to keep up with that.
Right.
You know, I think in terms of more specifically, I think right now, you know, safeguards deadline certainly has got a lot of folks scratching their head. And I mean, the extension to, what is it, June 9th, I believe. I think that helps. But, you know, there's still some pretty deep reviews that have to be done and some thought around coming up with, like, a safeguards policy and then, you know, all these other policies that have to be put in place. And then to operationalize those, it's a real challenge for folks.
Yeah, it's funny because that safeguards rule, it's funny as I learned about it, you know, over the last few years in terms of the changes, it's a little misleading because a lot of dealers might think the way it's worded, oh, that doesn't apply to me. And it really does apply to a lot more dealers than they think. Is that correct?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, when you look at, it's an FTC rule. And so it's written very broadly. So it swoops in a lot of dealers that maybe they thought they weren't, you know, subject to it, and a lot of other companies really that probably thought they weren't subject to it, but it's extremely broad.
Yes. Okay. And then we talked a little bit about this earlier about the CFPB and the FTC seeming to be obviously more aggressive in recent years. Outside of the safeguards rule, are there other regulatory issues that dealers and or lenders are facing in 2023?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot. And I was trying to think of, you know, how to break it down. I think you almost have to look at, like, the CFPB separately and then the FTC separately. I'll see if I can kind of summarize those.
Sure.
But I'll tell you this, like junk fees, for example, CFPB or the Bureau came out with prohibitions on so-called junk fees, where they said, if this is a fee that's charged to a consumer and it's really not providing a benefit, it's a quote unquote junk fee. Well, the FTC did something similar as well. So you can't really look at these federal agencies in a silo because they are, I'd say, working kind of hand in hand with each other on some of their attacks. In terms of, like, what the CFPB priority is, I mean, the last couple of days certainly have been interesting, or actually the last couple of months have been real interesting. You know, the CFPB came out with this registry of repeat offenders, where it's a proposed rule where they said if you've been subject to either a federal or maybe a state order or final order that involves, like, UDAPS or some of these other statutes, then you have to report and be noted on this registry or this bad actor list, these repeat offender lists.
Oh, gosh.
So that was proposed in December. And then they came out just here recently with another proposed rule about submitting if a supervised entity, like say like a larger auto finance company, a large participant, if they use any of these so-called offending clauses, like an arbitration clause or other clause that maybe limits their liability, then you have to register or file that with the CFPB. And I think that puts a huge target on that company from other federal regulators or state AGs or plaintiff's attorneys.
So they say if they use are using arbitration agreements, you report that. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. If you use an arbitration agreement, and it's not just limited arbitration agreements like they have done before, but it's if you use these other clauses that are basically limiting a consumer choice, basically limitation of liability might be one, or like a venue type clause, then you've got to submit your contracts, your agreements to the CFPB to be housed on their website.
No, so it's almost like you're putting yourself on the map, basically.
Right. And so I think what that may cause is, well, you're right. It puts you on the map, puts you on a big target on the website for others. But it also, I think, should cause folks to go, wait a minute, let's look at our contract again and, you know, kind of scale that back. Maybe we don't want to be as aggressive on, you know, limitation on liability or contractual gag clause or whatever it may be. So, I mean, it's a pretty sneaky way for the Bureau to attack arbitration kind of indirectly, where right. they can't attack it directly because they got shot down in, what, 2017?
Yeah, not maybe not necessarily a chilling effect, but kind of. But I like the way you talk about it and the idea that when stuff comes on the map or when you're forced to do that, it is interesting that it does force a dealer to kind of, okay, if I'm going to do this, it kind of gives a little heads up. Okay, I better make sure I got my ducks in a row in these areas.
Yeah, that's true.
That Tom Hudson was always, you know, have a curve on the whole arbitration issue. So that is interesting. Anything else that you hadn't mentioned or that regarding?
I mean, the Bureau's got a whole list of priorities, but I mean, certainly those two are top of mind. You know, if you are a quote unquote repeat offender, they've got they're coming after you. They're going to come back. They've got a whole, what do they call it? A repeat offender unit within their supervision. So if they do supervise those entities, they have a whole unit dedicated to coming back and checking to make sure that you're compliant with your prior order. Those are, I think the main things. I don't think that the changes in Congress with Republican led House versus Democrat controlled Senate, I don't think that's, I mean, certainly hadn't changed the Bureau's activity.
No.
In the last couple of they're going full steam ahead. So I don't see that changing in 2023, no matter how many times Director Chopra gets called to Congress to testify and they scold him, before Congress. I don't think that'll change things.
The divided Congress works both ways. You know what I mean? In this way, I mean, it stops some things, but also doesn't stop some things, right?
That's right. I mean, the way that they set the Bureau up, I mean, he's almost an absolute ruler. And the only way that you can really, I mean, yes, you have two avenues. You can submit a comment letter on some of these proposals, which, okay, it may go somewhere, probably won't. Or you can fight it in court like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has done or others have done. That's basically your two avenues. And I do see some of these being subject to challenge in the courts if they go forward with them.
Okay.
That's just the CFPB. I don't know if you mean talk briefly about what the FTC.
Sure. Yeah, please.
Okay. So yeah, we talked about the safeguards rule. You know, they have that motor vehicle trade regulation rule that they issued, I guess it was last July or so, which would just completely change how dealers operate. It seems fairly innocuous, but it's so confusing and it has so many requirements about, you know, keeping the communications and advertising and all that. that's, and I think they had, last I checked, it was over 11,000 comments. So that's going to take a while to probably hash through those.
Yeah, I was talking to Justin Osborne recently, reinsurance and 20 group guy, and he was saying that that was the same thing. Like, wow, that's a big deal.
Yeah. And I think that too could be subject to litigation if it ever comes out and is finalized. I can see folks challenging that one in court as well. They also have a junk fee rule that's proposed that seems rather broad when you compare it with some of the restrictions in that motor vehicle trade regulation rule. That they have a separate junk freeze rule that would apply to not just the automotive space, but concert tickets to
Oh, wow, that's a
the
big one.
airline industry. Yeah, I mean, talk about having a big target. If they release that rule, that could be a big target.
Wow.
They came out with a proposed rule that would ban non-compete clauses as well, and
Yeah,
that's
that just
another.
recently, yeah.
Yeah, so that's another big. I mean, they've got some bold initiatives at the FTC, and I think one of the commissioners who dissented to, I guess, their agenda of rules, I think she called it Rulapalooza, which I thought was great.
That
Because,
is great. Yeah.
I mean, because it's just a flurry of activity. And I don't know that we've seen the CPB and the FTC be this aggressive before.
Right.
Certainly not in my lifetime. Certainly not since the CPB's come up. So it's a perfect storm between the two, I think, right
Yeah,
now.
it's funny you say that because like 2 years ago when they had the changeover in administrations. It seemed like okay. I expect a lot of stuff happening that was pretty slow, and now, like you said, oh my gosh, the last few months has been very active.
Yeah.
Do you guys do anything, or you looked at the issue of can't think of the actual definition of the acronym, but CECL on the finance side?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Usually, yeah, usually we don't on the
Okay,
financial side like that.
that's cool. And then and we talked a lot about that. That's some great stuff. Generally speaking, when it comes to these type of say, regulatory issues by themselves, not necessarily legal, but whether they're big or small, how do you advise dealers? I mean, the general dealer and how to deal with these things. I mean, how should they look at it? How should they treat it? You know, in terms of freaking out or dismissing it, obviously there's somewhere in between there.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's I tend to focus on since we're a regulatory compliance firm, I try to tend to think of things in terms of compliance. You know, yeah,
Right.
have the freak out, complain about it, but let's rein it back. Let's get back to business on figuring out how to deal with these things. And you really can't boil the ocean in one swath, right? So
Right.
it's got to be bite-sized chunks that we're going to have to attack this. Now I tell folks, the fact that we're talking is a great sign because I think that means that you want to become more compliant. You want to run a squeaky clean operation, which is great. That's the first step. Because without that, anything else I say is just not going to matter if you don't have that kind of mindset. From there, and it depends on the dealer, but a lot of times I'll say, do you have a compliance officer? Do you have somebody that is tasked with compliance? If they don't, they need to get one. They need to give them the training, the tools, the resources, which means a budget, because without a budget, compliance budget, there is no compliance. But
Good.
you've got to get them trained up really to understand what's going on, what issues are out there. And that means going to like the NAF trainings or going to other
Yes.
trainings. Reading Spot Delivery is another great tool.
Yes.
There's a ton of free publications that the FTC has out there on their website that are great. And I tell folks, get them. They're free. You've paid for it as a taxpayer.
Yes.
They're free and they're actually really pretty good. So use those, and those will help you get your compliance house in order. So those are kind of the first steps. I think it kind of takes off from there, whether it's, helping somebody review their deal jacket documents or helping them develop a compliance management system, different policies and procedures. I think because anytime you develop like a policy and procedure, that helps you think of what risks do I have? Where are the
Yeah,
gaps that I have in my compliance and how can I shore those up? I try to think of it just from my background, being from the dealership side of things. I always think, if this was my dealership and my livelihood, how would I want to run this business? How would I want to shore things up to where, if, okay, I'm probably never going to be free of attack, but if I do get attacked, you know, how do I justify what we're doing? How do I handle consumer complaints so they don't escalate up to something that goes to the AG, the aspiring governor, or goes to a plaintiff's attorney, you know? So that's the way I kind of think of it.
I think of myself as a consumer. I'm not like a huge complainer or cause an uproar. I wouldn't go to the place again, but it is interesting that, do you think that typically if a dealer thinks like that, mm-hmm. that the average consumer, from your experience, isn't about escalating? There's always the person who does that, but mm-hmm. the average consumer just kind of wants to be listened to and addressed. I mean, do you find that happening?
I do. I think you're right. And I mean, we're all consumers, right? And, you know, we've got a complaint. We want to be heard. Resolution would be great, but I think you're right. I think most of the time it's just, they want to be heard. They want to be acknowledged, and they would like some sort of resolution. There's always going to be the one-offs where you're never going to be able to satisfy somebody. And I've dealt with those over the years, and that's a real challenge. But I think for the most part, people just want to be heard and acknowledged. And, you know, if you can deal with those at the dealership and have a complaint management program in place for those, and escalating up those types of complaints and keeping them within the dealership, that's, you know, that's a minimization of big risk, I think, and exposure right there.
Yeah, it's always like your personal budget, or if you have a bill issue or something like that, it's always, communication is better, and knowing about it is always better. Sometimes we want to ignore things, but it's like, if you know about it, you really drop that fear level down, outside of just not the surprises and handling an issue, but you really take that into that fear factor now, like, oh my gosh, what do I do?
That's right. Yeah. And you have these plans in place beforehand, hopefully, before these come in. It's almost like if you had a security breach, you know, somebody, you know, broke into your email system or whatever. I mean, you've got to have these plans in place beforehand, so you know what to do. Because whenever it's crisis mode, it's hard to think straight, right?
Absolutely.
You know, it's hard to deal with things logically when it is, pulse is elevated, blood pressure's up, you know. Yes. That's why it's important to have these things down on paper. We have a plan, you know. Hopefully it doesn't come up, but if it does, we've got a plan in place here.
Yeah, it's like a sports team, you know. It's like that quarterback is like, if you do all this stuff in practice, then you won't freak out when it comes mm-hmm. to that situation in game time.
That's right.
And then the truth of the matter is, I mean, my experience following this is, boy, when I look at FTC, CFPB, state regulation, no dealer's bulletproof. There's just I doubt anybody's following the rules. People hear that and they think, oh my gosh, but it just is, it's just too hard. But I do think that these type of things, how do you tell dealers that you probably never be completely 100% bulletproof, mm-hmm. but these things do what? How do they protect you, or how do they prevent those worst case scenarios?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, no one's going to be 100% compliant. It just, I mean, if you're 100% compliant like that, you'd spend so much time doing that, and you'd never sell cars, right? Or you'd never, you know, buy contracts and finance them. So I think it really is an issue of minimizing your risk and your exposure, trying to figure out where the big issues are, what risks you may have. A lot of these policies, you would conduct what they call a risk assessment, you know, to go through and try to, you talked about, you know, at least knowing and understanding. That's a big part of it, is let's go through and try to understand what risk we may have, what exposure we may have. Now that we've come to terms with that, how can we minimize the damage that may occur if XYZ happens or this happens? And I think that's a big part of it.
Okay, one of the last things I want to ask you is, what is it like when you talk to dealers, work with dealers, is there, when it comes to law or compliance or regulation, is there something, or their issue or two or whatever, that they just, that you're surprised either they don't understand or something they should understand, that's the biggest thing? I mean, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, and I suppose it depends on the complexity of the dealer.
Right.
But what I've found is that particularly with some of the, I'd say even smaller to even some of the larger dealerships, maybe rooftops in multiple states, they don't, I don't think they understand the risk, particularly if they are servicing and collecting on their accounts, right? So they've got a customer that goes into default. State law requires they send either a right to cure notice, or maybe they've repossessed the vehicle and then they have to send out like a notice of sale or some other state required notice. I don't think folks understand how much trouble they could get in, how much liability and exposure they may have if the letter doesn't says what it's supposed to say, or if they're not sending it out at the right time, or if their calculations are off on some of these letters. There's just a lot of exposure in the statute for sending out a notice that doesn't comply. And these are form notices for the most part, right? So it's every time you're sending out a notice like that, $500, or there's, 10 times the finance charge on this contract. I mean, there's a lot of exposure. And I think people just don't understand you can't go out and repo the vehicle and then tell the consumer, eh, we're just gonna, put it back on our lot and we'll sell it back on our lot. It's not that easy, And I fielded questions from dealers at conferences, I don't know, for many years like that. And I'm still seeing that from dealers. So I think that's the biggest exposure. And it's probably one of the easiest ways to easiest things to fix, but you have to know that it's an issue. You have to understand that you are exposed,
I was thinking one of the early conferences I went to where Tom Hudson spoke, and he's just so funny and dry about stuff. And somebody would say something, and he'd look at him like, "Man, you shouldn't be doing that. That is not the way to handle it."
Oh yeah. Yeah, I'd love going to the conferences where, Tom was there, or working the counselor library booth with Tom, because I just kind of sit back and watch Tom do his magic, and people would ask him questions and he would just, his head was getting ready to explode, but you're right, just very calmly just kind of go, no, you don't need to be doing that. And knowing that they don't know what, bad things they may be doing, or just don't understand how they're getting themselves into, potential exposure. So.
And I think that's what you guys do at these conferences when you have the Q&As, which are always the best because every dealer's got a different situation. But that one dealer asking the question, there's probably 10 dealers saying, "Yeah, I want to know about that." And to be able to say that you're not acting as the regulator or the enemy, you're saying, "Okay, this is where you're messing up." But they're, you guys are always trying to help them, okay, to see it in the way that a regulator or lawsuit may see it, I guess.
Yeah, and that's I love going to the conferences and speaking to dealers, or getting the fielding the questions from dealers like that, because I mean you learn a lot about their mindset and what they're thinking. But I mean, some great questions, and dealers are some of the most entrepreneurial folks I've probably ever met. If there's a roadblock here, then they find a way around it, or they've got an alternative business plan, and so it's fantastic for that. But yeah, you get some interesting questions and you're like, we need to talk, because let's talk about this. But I see it in a way as trying to help educate the dealer. I would much rather they hear from us first
For
on,
sure.
than certainly the AG or a plaintiff's attorney. But yeah, it's gonna be really helpful.
And I'll say to dealers, if you're paying money for you or your staff to go to an NIADA conference or whichever NAF, wherever you guys are, I mean, you're getting advice that's gold, and you're not paying for it. I mean, you're getting it as part of the cost of attending the conference. So those are great times. I would always recommend people ask the questions while you guys are in front of you. And then again, you'll learn one, okay, this is what I'm doing right, but I could probably tweak it here. And then more importantly, boy, this is what I'm not doing or I'm doing wrong. And that's huge.
I agree. I mean, we do that legal committee panel every year at NAF, and it's surprising we don't get many questions. And I was, I look at the other panelists. I'm like, look, if you add up all their billable hours, $1,500, $2,000 right here at the table. Ask your questions. Now, it's not legal advice, okay? That's fine, but it's an answer that you could get and explore further. But take advantage of that.
Absolutely. What do you have any Are there any conferences coming up that you guys will be at, whether you or what, somebody from Hudson Cook?
Yeah, I know a big group of us are going down to AFSA in a couple of weeks in Dallas.
Good.
One or two of us may stick around for NADA afterwards. I'm not sure, but I know I'll be down at AFSA. And then
excellent.
I started looking at my conference list for the year. So we've got others that were, you know, certainly have flagged and submitting speaking proposals for. So
very good.
Get back on the conference circuit again this year.
It's nice. It's nice to be back in person. That's a big deal. Boy, we covered a lot.
Yeah. I would just say, you know, if I was a dealer that needed, you know, didn't know where to start out, I mean, I would say certainly think about having first level, just have a deal jacket review done.
Yes.
You know, just to see the documents that are consumer facing, that I have them sign. Do I have any problems with my documentation? Mm-hmm. That'll tell you. I love looking at deal jackets because I can usually tell what shape like a dealer is in terms of their compliance, regulatory issues, where they might be exposed, just by looking at, you know, what documents a consumer would see.
Yes.
And I think from there, then you can ratchet it up in different stages, you know, looking at policies and procedures or a CMS. But if nothing else, have a deal jacket review done to see, you know, I'm presenting to hundreds of consumers, if not more.
Yeah.
What do they see? What could they challenge and attack?
You know? And that's a fairly reasonable cost, I would assume, for a deal or something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's fairly minimal cost, minimal time. I probably spend more time looking at the documents than I will ever bill, just because I try to be very thorough and try to understand.
Yes.
And try to provide, you know, like a good memo of what we found and, you know, advice on here's an issue, here's, you know, possible corrections. So minimal cost, big reward.
Great. And you know, just to repeat what we talked about, the National Automotive Finance Association does have this program, the Consumer Credit Compliance Certification Program. If you're financing your own cars, or you have a related finance company, anything like that, obviously that any type of education certification you want, not only is it good for you, I would think that it's good to have something on your resume so that the regulators see that you're making those efforts. And then of course, looking for Hudson Cook, they have books on F&I, they have lots of stuff that they provide. And of course, definitely Spot Delivery. We've used it and we've actually run stories from Spot Delivery. It's a great publication, dealers, if you want to get just a little bit of the current landscape of what you're dealing with for a layman, but also you're getting deep knowledge. So that's a really good thing. So boy, Eric, I really appreciate your time. This has been great. Stuff like this is always good for me as a reporter, but I know they're really good for dealers to learn things themselves.
You know, if folks do get into trouble, which happens from time to time.
Yes.
I mean, both from a litigation standpoint or the regulator, you know, CFPB or other state regulators come knocking. We also have a separate group called our Government Investigations Practice Group that works with clients on examinations or enforcement actions or CIDs. So we can sure help from the front end on compliance, as well as if something hits the fan, we can help them there too.
Boy, yeah, thank goodness you brought that up, because that's probably the one that you really, when you get to that point, you really need a, you know, folks like you guys there. Yeah. Well, this is great. Erica Johnson from Hudson Cook, great organization. And again, Eric's always been a great resource for Used Car News, so I do appreciate that. And again, NAF, look him up through there. And look for them out on the convention circuit and conference circuit, and ask those questions, people. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Get that free question answered. I appreciate it. Again, Spot Delivery, all the stuff that Hudson Cooks offers. We appreciate your time today.
You bet. Thanks again for having me. I appreciate it.
The National Automotive Dealers Association is preparing for its annual convention in the wake of a strong year for the organization. Mike Stanton, NDA President and CEO, discussed today's business environment during a recent phone conversation from his home office in Tysons, Virginia. The convention will be January 26th through the 29th in Dallas. The Dealer Academy posted record numbers, having 500 to 600 students. The Dealer Academy is a school for future dealers. Typically, these students could be a partner in a store or a dealer's child wanting to take over the family business. Mike also added that membership numbers were up over 90% for franchise dealers. The convention in Dallas has a strong educational lineup along with traditional franchise meetings. On the social side, the event kicks off at the famous Gillies Bar in Dallas with Grammy Award-winning country music star Brad Paisley providing entertainment. Speakers will include former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley, NFL Hall of Famer and new University of Colorado head football coach Deion Sanders, and Greg Gutfeld of Fox News. J.D. Power's used car market outlook showed strong trends for the industry as well as a few challenges. Both new and used car prices shot up to record highs in 2022, according to last month's report. Average used car retail prices were $30,816 for 2022, nearly $4,000 higher than the year before and $9,000 over 2019. J.D. Power provided an example of this by looking at a 2016 Toyota Camry. In January of 2019, the price of the car was $16,351. Then it dropped to $13,546 in January of 2021, before climbing again to a price of $17,482 in November of 2022. During 2022, the average used car prices actually topped $32,000 before dropping in the fourth quarter. New car prices averaged $45,000 for 2022, nearly $5,000 more than 2021 and almost $12,000 more than 2019. J.D. Power's annual valuation services show that used vehicles have peaked and should soften in this year and in 2024. Justin Osborne, founder and CEO of Automotive Reinsurance Concepts, has launched Independent Dealer University, a subscriptions-based online dealer education program. Osborne describes it as a comprehensive training program that will eventually offer a full curriculum of on-demand interactive video lessons covering all areas of dealership operations. The courses are taught by Osborne and National Training Director and F&I Guru 3K, Corey Collins. Osborne served as lead instructor of the National Independent Automobile Dealers Association acclaimed Certified Master Dealer course from 2017 to the end of 2019. The subscription includes unlimited use within the dealership, along with a weekly Zoom meeting on sales and F&I. Osborne says there's currently nothing else like this available anywhere else. Thanks for listening to Used Car News Podcast. Each month we'll bring you fast and reliable news that car dealers can rely on for this evolving industry. For a free subscription of Used Car News, please go to usedcarnews.com. This podcast is a production of BG Ad Group. Make sure to share us on social media and like and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to save up to 80% on steep new tire prices? Premium used tires, like used cars, are a safe and affordable option when purchased from reputable sellers like Champ Tires. With more than 40,000 tires in stock, all you need to do is go to champtires.com to find the exact size, brand and model, and tread depth you need. Every tire is inspected and air tested, and shipping is free. This savings tip works when you need to replace one, two, or even all four tires. Shop at champtires.com today.